Take number two.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I think that's kind of nice.
Yeah, we,
you get to do some of your own fishing to get the protein.
Yeah, yeah, we went to some pretty neat, some pretty interesting places.
Caribbean quite a bit.
Yeah, we went through the canal. We hung around the canal for quite a while. We were around Panama for about, 89 months. Went into the San Blas Islands. On the other side, they've got some kind of interesting native people. There's 360 some of these islands between Panama and Colombia. And they're little sand islands. Some of them are more than an acre. Some of them are maybe 5 to 10 acres. But they're really real big ones. And the Cuna Indians live there. And they are a colorful bunch. At least they're pretty colorful in those areas where the missionaries are. Missionary islands are pretty drab and colorful, and they're colorless, and they've got lots on the border. People look at them suspiciously. But the other people wear gold rings in their nose and gold earrings and these really wild things you call mullahs, very colorful blouses and stuff like that. They live in little bash huts. They're really a neat culture. They do a little farming over on the mainland, and they live on the islands. So anyway, we spent some time there, Portobello is an interesting place. It's an old gold. It was a gold and silver shipment port for the Spanish when they were down in that area. They brought the gold up from the gold and silver and gems and all this stuff. They brought it up from Peru, and they landed it on the Pacific side of the Isthmus of Panama. And then they hauled it by mule train across to the bay there at Portobello, and. And once a year, or sometimes it'd be 2 or 3 years between these fairs, but the fleet would come in from Spain with all kinds of supplies that they couldn't get over this side. They would then haul back the gold and silver back to Europe. And so that area, a guy with a metal detector can do really well. We did know one boat. It was a couple, and they spent about 7 or 8 years down there. And I didn't realize what they were doing at the time. I knew that they had some artifacts and stuff that they picked up doing there. They showed me like an old Spanish breastplate or something like that. But I found out later from another cruiser, and after we had quit cruising, these people had been doing some serious informal archaeology. They'd worked it over a number of things. They found a lot of stuff. But if you have the summit for it, you can follow the old trail. I mean, the trail is not marked. You have to figure out where the trail was. But there's silver bars and stuff laying there that they hadn't bothered to pick up, because mules would dry or die, or they'd drop stuff on the trail and things like that. And silver was the cheap that they didn't bother to worry about. In the plaza there in Portobello, they talked about how the gold went into the storehouse, but the silver piled up in the square, and piled 8 or 10 feet high. We left there, we sailed to an island. The two islands are owned by Colombia, off the coast of Nicaragua. And Providencia, what's the name again? San Andres. San Andres is kind of a resort island for Colombia. It's not a very big island, but there's some hotels there, and you know, people come up there on vacation. 50 miles north of there is another island called Providencia, which was founded by the same, by the Providence Company, the same people who founded Providence, Rhode Island. It split. When they left England, it split in two groups. And one of them went to Rhode Island, the other group went to Providencia, which on the old charts is called Old Providence, or New Providence, Old Providence. And so they landed there, and their descendants, some of their descendants are still there. It's a really deep old English island. But the island sits astride the Spanish Main, and Morgan, the pirate, established a very substantial fort on the island. It's all overgrown now as we need it. And things like that, but I forgot my what I was going to say. Anyway, well, there's a lot of artifacts that have been left around. Okay. The thing is that it's very difficult to get to Providence. Very few people can get there. There's a small plane that will fly you out of San Andres, but they will only take a very few people, and those are people who say there's about half a dozen little kind of tourist houses, bungalows, that are owned by a little airline company, so they'll fly people up there, and that's about it. Otherwise, you can't get on a plane, and the officials won't let you go. And there's a boat that comes in there every couple of weeks and brings supplies into the island and stuff. But otherwise, the only way you have to stow away on that. Otherwise, the only way is if you have your own boat. And this, like I say, this has been a pretty remote part of the Caribbean. So we sailed in there. One time we stayed about a week. And we left. We were going to go up to Honduras. And it happened that we hit a phenomenon that they call the Christmas wind. It happens every year up here, long about Christmas time. There's a gale comes down out of the north, and it just blows and blows. And we got driven back to the Providencia, and we stayed there for another 6 weeks. And we got to know the island pretty well, and we got to know some of the people there, and we got to do a little bit of exploring, and it was fascinating, poking around that whole fort. Pretty good.
He's looking at some of the stuff that's up here.
Well, those are replicas. Those guns.
Some of the dagger here, that real north coordinate one.
Oh, that's a melee, Chris, from down around Malaysia and Sumatra, that area. I was going to show you some of the artifacts that we dug up, and I don't know if I'm going to talk to you. But we found, I got poking around in the in the dirt there in that fort one time, there was a place that overlooked the, it was like a lookout area. It was up pretty much near the top of the whole thing. And started turning up flints, old cannon flints, and rifle flints, musket flints. And rifle or musket balls, pieces of old weapons and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. We found it under it. And that was without a metal detector. I didn't have a metal detector. But yeah, we got to know that place pretty well.
All of the gems and stuff that you've got, any of the Alaskan gold or anything here? You're working on the jewelry and stuff? Do you do any of the panning and find your own?
Oh, yeah, I've done that. Over on the mainland. Now, there's something interesting about Kodiak. I don't know that it's a stream. All I know is that there's plaster deposit not too far from here. There was a guy out on the base, and he was a corpsman, a first class corpsman. And that was a hobby of his, painting gold and so forth, right? And he went out, and I think it's somewhere in the general area of Anthony Bay. And he came back with a whole handful of really nice money. He was taken out there. He never told anybody exactly what it was. But of course, you know, there's no gold mine over there.
No.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of gold mines. There's several gold mines in there. They're hard rock mines. And one of them's out by Anton Larson, the other one's down at Ammo. Muncie's Bear Camp is actually the mine buildings, the old gold mine. And as a matter of fact, the mouth of the mine is about 100 feet or so from there. From their main building. And there's a rock there in the bay where, there's a wreck down there, and I think it's the name of it. I think it's Columbia. I think that's the name of it. It's sunk. And I've never been able to get it straight whether they had loaded ore and then sunk, or whether they sunk before they got there to load the ore. But there's some people that say that it's got a load of gold ore in the rest.
Mm. Were there any gems or anything up here?
No.
I never said about the geodes up here. Any of those things around there?
No.
Scale?
No, a guy brought me couple of rocks here a while back. Larry Amos. You know Larry? Mm-hmm. Larry, he's pretty well known around town. And wait around here for quite a while. Oh yeah, here's one. He brought me the rock and he asked me if I'd cut a couple of stones from it. He said there's stuff that came off the Kodiak. And so I see, you know, that's not particularly pretty. It does take a good polish. It's fairly hard. I'm not exactly sure what it is. But that's about as close as I've seen to any kind of decent cutting material here on the island. There's another gold location down at what they call Seven Mile Beach. South Indian Island, you heard that?
No.
Yeah. Back during the Depression, there were miners that worked down there all the time. As a matter of fact, there was a guy here, Oh, gosh, that's got to be 20 years ago, I guess. Young fellow came up from outside someplace, and he knew about that deposit. And he hired a goose, and he loaded up some equipment and camping gear and all that sort of thing. And he went down to Seven Mile Beach, and he started washing sand. And he was taking an ounce a day. And it's a real fine, it's a very fine gold. It's really fine, silky and stuff, but it's still gold. But the trouble was that he didn't take enough supplies down there, and we ran into a stretch of real bad weather. And he ended up having to spend all of his time surviving, finding something to eat. And so he didn't get to spend a whole lot of time mining. But I saw some of the stuff that he brought back. And, yeah, he was doing fine. Down by Red River. Yeah. You can go down there today and you can go, you know, just like to get it off of Sipkalitic, you know, there's a really going operation down there, Sipkalitic, today.
Yeah, I thought the only thing they had was up in the interior and June and stuff like that.
No, there's a number of claims have been, I don't know what the status of them in Sipkalitic is right now. I think there's still a couple that live down there. But yeah, there's money for gold and some other mineral that they're real quiet about. I talked to a guy that was down there, I was fixing my airplane. And I was a hanger out there at the airport a few years ago. This guy was, he came in with all kinds of equipment and stuff that he was, and he was staging and he was flying down to the creator. Yeah. He was obviously putting a lot of money into this thing. Mm-hmm. And, but he never would say what he was going after. He said,
do you have your own airplane?
Not anymore. I sold it a couple years ago. I came up here, as soon as we got here, the Navy had a flying club up at the base. And, so I joined the flying club and fly. Got a hold of an Arctic sedan and floats. Flew that for a while. And sold that. I got a PA-12 and flew that for a while. Then I sold that and bought a sailboat. But when we came back here, I bought a Chicago float and flew that for a number of years. I lost my medical here about a couple years ago. So I sold the plane. I guess I sold the plane to the region.
Do all your hunting, a lot of the hunting trips and stuff where you could get in?
Mostly I use it for fishing. You know, there's places around here where half an hour flying time, 25 minutes, and then you put yourself in a really nice wilderness location where you're not going to see anybody else, probably. You know, a lot of places. Yeah, I miss the airplane that I had, first one I had, you know, Boy Scout Lake?
Uh-huh.
Can you imagine somebody flying a float plane off of Boy Scout Lake?
No.
They had a guy up here, his name was Cook Cleveland. And Cook was a captain in the Navy, and he was chief of staff up here at the 17th Naval District. And, but he was one of the Navy's really hot shot aviators, you know, World War II ace, Korean ace. And he flew souped up F-4U in the Cleveland Air Races, and he won that a couple of times. He was really hot stuff, right? Well, he had this Aranca sedan that he totaled out three times while he was here, you know, got it rebuilt. Well, that's the one I ended up with it after the last time he wiped it out. He and the Admiral and some other guy were over on a podium and they were hunting elk. And So Cook took the airplane up, and really early in the morning, and he was out scouting around, because they, back in those days, you know, you could hunt and shoot the same day. It was illegal. So he was scouting around for the herd, and I don't know, he came back in low and slow or something, and he mushed it into a patch of alder. And so we wiped out a float and damaged both wings and some fuselage and this and that. Anyway, they got it hauled out of there and brought back to base. So when we got here, it was sitting there. You know.
And about what year was that?
That was 67. So yeah, it was sitting out there in the hangar on the base and just kind of looking forlorn. Well. The flying club bought the airplane. Well, the deal was that Cook kind of ran the flying club. And the flying club, when he had it, had only two airplanes. It had the Sinatra sedan, and it had an old rocket Champ, and that was it. So the club still owned this the sedan. Well, we had a Harry Acorn. And Harry had been in general aviation pretty much his whole life. And he was an excellent flight instructor, excellent mechanic, and a guy who lived and breathed light aircraft. Well, he kind of took over running, or at least inspiring the club. So, and he got here just about the time we did. Well, he started building it then. He actually started getting 150s and then 172. Another guy on the outside and flew back to 172. But anyway, we got a T-34 from the Navy. We had a Republic CB. What else did we get? No, we had a Mooney. We had a bunch of them. And, so anyway, that's when I learned to fly. And I, after I didn't even have my license yet. But another guy and I were in a partnership and bought this old sedan and they fixed it up. Harry and a couple of these other guys, you know, they fixed it up and got it going again. So that summer, Jerry Geyer was the guy that I told you about. He was the recreation director. Right? Well, Jerry was pilot, and so he was my partner in the airplane. Of course, I couldn't fly it. But we were going to go fishing one day. It was a beautiful day in June up there in Hilly Lake. And Norma, my wife, was going to go with us. So we didn't want to take off the lake with three people because, you know, kind of a short way. So we're going to land in the channel and pick her up down in the channel. So Jerry and I are in the airplane, and we start up the lake there, and I still to this day don't know what happened. I think he may have pulled it off too soon or something, but anyway, it mushed back onto the lake and stacked up against the far end. So there we are without an airplane for another year. But I bought him out, and then had that claim for another few years. But yeah, that's the flying up there. Yeah. Bob, my youngest son, Bob and I crashed an airplane up in Brooks Range. Been about 7 years ago now. 6, 7 years ago. We were up there for 5 days before we got out. Weren't hurt.
Yeah.
But did you notice the little dents in his forehead when you look at him that closely?
No, I didn't notice.
Well, he racked one up here about 3 years ago up in the Brooks Range. He's a guy. Mm-hmm. He's a guy. Yeah. He racked it up and broke his neck.
Ooh.
And real close to getting killed. Yeah.
What happened when you guys crashed?
We had landed on a little sheet strip up in the Alaska Range. And the sheep strip is just a kind of, you know, there'll be like a creek bottom, or it's a creek in flood, but the rest of the year it's just a sort of an alluvial plain with a little creek running down the middle of it, right? And there's a lot of them up there like that. This is up at about 3,000 feet. And somebody had come in there and cleared some rocks for a couple hundred feet. You know, that's the chief. They took the big ones out. Yeah. So we landed in there and stayed overnight, and then we hunted the next day, but it looked like it wasn't going to do any good. We decided to hunt and go someplace else. And packed up the airplane. About this time, the wind was starting to come up. It was getting kind of squirrely. For whatever aerodynamic reason, didn't get completely off the ground. We got just up in the ground effect, about, you know, with the wheels about 2 feet above the terrain, but it couldn't be any altitude. And we didn't have enough speed for aileron control, and so we flew into a bank. Mm. And totaled the airplane completely. So we, fortunately, we had all kinds of camping gear and stuff with us, so we set that up, and then the wind came on to blow, and it did blow, it had to blow 100 that night. It blew the tent down too, and it was a really sturdy tent. But, so we would have lost the airplane any way you look at it. If we hadn't taken off then, because there was no way that we could have kept that airplane from blowing away at that night. But anyway, yeah, so the ceiling came down and it snowed and there was, you know, and I didn't know how long we were going to be up there. There was a band of sheep on the mountain, and we saw it the first day. There weren't any good rams in it, but, you know, there's a number of sheep. And then they went away. The wind blew and everything. We were starting to run a little low on chow. I didn't know, like I say, how long we were going to be there. So on the fifth day, we decided to take one of these sheep, you know, for survival rations, which is legal. You need it. So we took one, and I was skinning it out, and the clouds opened up. Little blue spots started showing through. Here comes this airplane. It was a CAP plane. They heard our ELT from the, they knew that we were down, or that somebody was down in that area within half an hour of crash. We had no way of knowing. Took us out of the helicopter from the ground. But that's the kind of stuff that, you know, that's pretty common, I think.
Normally I'm on the other end of the helicopter, yeah. Picking the people up.
We had a bad plane crash in the flying club. Must have been, I guess it was the winter, I guess it must have been the fall of 69. And I lived in quarters on the base over there, and we were having a little party there on Friday evening. And some of the flying club guys and everybody all were there. Harry Acor was there, couple of civilian pilots, and got this phone call. This plane was overdue, and three guys in it going over the fog net. The pilot was a flight instructor, and the other two guys were just guys that were hunters. They wanted to, they were going to go out the next day elk hunting, and they wanted to go over and look over the terrain and, you know, all this stuff. So this guy showed them over there. Well, they got overdue for an hour or so, and they knew that they had to be down someplace. Mm-hmm. And then the Coast Guard went out, I guess, not too long after that, when about 11 o'clock at night, they got in there with a... They located the wreck, and they got in there with a walkout gear. One of the crewmen got out and checked it out and felt around in there, and you know, he knew it was all dead, all cold. And, so then the next morning, Harry Acor and the trooper, Bob Lockman, and I, and the doctor from the base, loaded into an helicopter, and he flew over there, and it was still, it was low ceiling day, remember that. They could only, and the wind was gusting down on this canyon before it crashed. And, the pilot only wanted to take in one guy at a time, so they dropped everybody off out of the down at the recreation camp, and they flew me in. Dropped me off and went back to get somebody else. And that was kind of spooky because you know, there you were, and the winds were kind of howling down off of the peak, and otherwise it was dead calm with these three bodies. It took us all day long to cut them out of that wreckage and put them body back. But that was a bad one. We had, used to have a lot more light plane crashes. Than we had since I got back.
Any idea why they changed?
Oh, I don't know. I think I've got to give the FAA credit for this thing. And I think, I don't know, I think the guys who were flying, the pilots who were flying, I'm talking about the air taxi out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the most part, I think they have a somewhat different attitude. By God, then they flew in weather that I don't think you'd think about going. They did it regularly. And some of those guys, they've been doing it for a long time. I don't know. But it seems like we had quite a few. Jerry McDonald, the guy that used to be a butcher out there, right next to the Beachcomber. The ship was on one side of the parking lot, and then the butcher shop was there. The Salvation Army was now. And he crashed into a mountain on the way to the bay. And the guy that used to own the Kodiak Airways, his son crashed, Roots coming back. I think they're coming back from Olga. Killed the pilot, trooper, and a couple other people. I don't know, it just seemed like there were a lot of them.
Kind of flying a little bit more in the weather where they shouldn't be.
I guess so. I don't really know. Yeah, you know, we've had a few recently, but it seems to me that since that one, the crash over in Homer, when was that, 7, 8 years ago, maybe, you know what that one was, it was a little commuter aircraft.
Okay.
It came out here, had a bunch of deer hunters. The deer hunters all had meat, and it was way over there.
Oh.
And the crash of the boat. And since then, I think there was a change in attitude. I know for a long time, I don't know if it's still going on, but for a long time, the Apaches agreed that they wouldn't fly over the boat.
Yeah, that's just asking for trouble, huh?
But that used to be standard. Gil Jarvella was a bush pilot back up in those days. He was good. He'd been flying for years. And he was a real cub pilot. I was talking to him one time and I said, Gil, what's the heaviest you ever took off in a Super Cub? And he said, I don't know how much weight we had in it. He said, but I was over on the peninsula. And he said, I had a camp and a couple of moose hunters. And I'd flown the moose hunters over to another lake to hunt that day. And flew them over, you know, one at a time. It wasn't all that far away. And then I should pick them up and eat them the same way. And he said, when I got over there, he said the weather was coming down and deteriorating, and I was only going to be able to make some one trip, so I'm going to have to take both of these guys back. And he said, they were both pretty big guys, and they had a moose. And so he said, we tied the meat to the floats, you know, to the struts. And then we put the two guys in the back of this cub. But the big guys and all the gear, life engine, all of this other stuff. And he says, when I taxied out to take off, he said, three of the float covers, the aft three float covers, were submerged. They were all underwater. He said, but I got her off. He said it was blowing like crazy, you know, and that helped. Some of those were did some weird things. And I just wonder whether a lot of maybe some of the younger pilots didn't try to emulate the feats that these old pilots pulled.
Yeah, maybe it goes with the old and the bold pilots or old pilots. And there are bold pilots,
but there are no old pilots.
With that, I've got about an hour and a half of material.
I can keep talking for hours.
Editing. Deep. No.
You turn that off. I'll show you something.
Oh.